On August 4, 2015, noted historian and prolific author William J. Federer returned to WFYL and was our guest on It's a New Day from 7 to 8 a.m. He shared with WFYL listeners his perspective on what is happening in the U.S. and the world today based upon his grasp and knowledge of history and the Bible. Here is that interview. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to It's a New Day here on 1180 WFYL, Working for Your Liberty. This is Susan Locke. We're so pleased to have you with us this morning. That voice you just heard, American Minute, is the voice of William J. Federer, and he is with us this morning. We are so thrilled to have him as our guest. Bill, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, great to be with you.
Good morning. Thank you. It's wonderful to have you with us again. A little over a year ago, last April, you spent about an hour giving us and our listeners a marvelous overview of world history. I've never heard anything like it, and we have had so many calls and emails and responses to that. So we're thrilled, and I know our listeners will be also, to have you with us again today. Let me just share a little bit of your background. William J. Federer is a nationally known speaker, best-selling author of over 20 books, right, Bill?
Correct,
President of Amerisearch, Inc., a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. And his American feature, American Minute radio feature, is broadcast daily across America and right here on our station as well. You are so accomplished in so many areas, Bill. You've been on television, you've been on radio, you travel around the country. We could talk about that for a long time, but we would just like to turn this time over to you and let you talk and share some of that knowledge and insight that you have. What I would especially like to ask of you today is if you could share your perspective on what's happening now here in the U.S. and around the world in light of your historical knowledge and grasp of history.
Well, thank you so much. And several different things I see coming together. And we have communist type of efforts of, you know, centralizing power in Washington, also globally, and then also with Islam. And in an unusual sense, the Muslim Brotherhood is a cross-pollinization between the worst of both. We've always thought of communism on one side, Islam on the other. Well, now we have the Muslim Brotherhood has communist goals and motivations using, Islamic goals and motivations using communist tactics. But a little bit of a background I think is worthwhile. Mm-hmm. There's a historian, Arthur Schlesinger. Mm-hmm. And he was on staff with John F. Kennedy. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. He said, "History is to the nation as memory is to the individual. History is to the nation as memory is to the individual." So if you can imagine an individual who's lost their memory, they don't remember who they are, they don't remember who you are, maybe they have Alzheimer's. In America, we've lost our memory. Yes. Here we are, the freest and most prosperous country that planet Earth has ever seen, mm-hmm. and we forgot how we got here. And as a result, we're letting it slip through our fingers like sand. And so the history, I think, is important. As a matter of fact, Winston Churchill once said, "The farther back you can look, the farther forward you are likely to see." In other words, human behavior is pretty predictable. You go to any high school, kids fall into the same general categories, and you go into any government, people fall into the same categories, and you look through the different centuries, and people sort of fall into the same categories. And so one of the things that I looked at was power. And what the most common form of government is in world history. And after researching thousands of different kingdoms, it came pretty clear that the most common form of government is a king. They go by different names: Pharaoh, Caesar, Kaiser, Sultan, Tsar, Maharaja, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar, Attila the Hun, King Kamehameha. The name changes, but the function remains the same. You get a bunch of people together, one of them ends up being in charge. Sort of a type A personality, and you get some, you know, girls together, there's a clique. You know, you get some kids together on a playground, one of them is the bully hogging the ball. Put some people in the woods, one of them's the Indian chief. Even put some kids in a playpen, one of them will take the rattle from the others.
It's human nature, right?
You know, put some people in the inner city, one of them is a gang leader. And all a king is, in a sense, is a glorified gang leader. Now, I think it goes back to the fall in the garden and Cain killing Abel and selfishness coming into the human DNA. And so what I found fascinating was several things. One is the first human records appear about 3,000 or 4,000 B.C., Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. It was started as an accounting method where they, if you ever tallied things and you go 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you draw a line across the lines to make 5. And so these cuneiforms is where they took a stick and poked it into clay and made little symbols, and they had 1,500 cuneiform characters. And this was the beginning of writing. And so if you think of it, 3,000 or 4,000 B.C., and we're around 2,000 A.D., that's 6,000 years. And in a sense, 6,000 years is not that long. It's only 60 people living 100 years each, back to back. We're talking 60 grandmothers, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. And the most common form of government is a king. Now, as the centuries go on, these kingdoms get bigger and bigger and bigger. So Sargon of Akkadia conquers from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean. And then you have 2,000 years with 18 major Egyptian dynasties. And then you have the Cyrus of Persia and Darius of, you know, the Medo-Persian Empire and Alexander the Great and the Indian Maharajas and Chinese emperors, 5,000 years of Chinese emperors. And then the Roman emperors and the Byzantine emperors and the Muslim sultans and the King of Spain, France, and Austria. But the most powerful king in world history was who? It was the King of England. And at that time, the British Empire, the king controlled 13 million square miles and a half a billion people. All of India, which contained a quarter of the world's population right there. And so we see that when America was started, our founding fathers decided to run as far away from a king as they could. And they took the power of a king and broke it into three branches, separated it federal to state level, tied up this federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs. All our Constitution is, in a sense, is a bunch of hurdles to prevent power from reconcentrating back into the hands of a king.
Yes.
And what I found interesting, and interrupt me at any time, what I found interesting was that our founders, wrote our Constitution, the whole rest of the world was ruled by kings. The Chinese emperors, Japanese emperors, Queen Catherine the Great of Russia, 12 time zones, all controlled by one person. You had the, you know, King George III in France. You had King Louis the 16th. You had the Austro-Hungarian emperors, Spanish kings, maybe a little left of what was the Dutch United Netherlands, the seven provinces united together against Spain, and they were somewhat of a republic until Napoleon conquered them. But the majority of the world was kings, and so America's founders decided to comb through history to look for alternatives of kings, to look for examples where people tried to rule themselves without a king. And yes, they looked to Rome and Greece, but the first example they looked at was Israel. That's right, Israel. Around 1500 BC is when Israel came out of Egypt, and for those first 400 years, they did not have a king. Matter of fact, the president of Harvard in 1788 was Samuel Langdon. And Samuel Langdon gave a message, and it was the Republic of the Israelites as an example to the American states. And so the 12 tribes of Israel, they all each had their own leadership, but they'd all got together for their leaders with the Sanhedrin. And so we had the 13 colonies, and each one had their own governments, but they could all send their representatives to the federal government. And But it got even more fascinating when you look at this. So Israel, around 1500 B.C., they come into the Promised Land, and for the first 400 years, Israel did not have a king. Everyone was equal before the law. And the law said there was no respect of persons in judgment. Rich or poor, everyone's to be treated the same. Male, female, made in the image of the Creator. Even the stranger living amongst you is under the same law that you're under. And lo and behold, this is the beginning of the concept of equality on planet Earth, that everyone you see is equal to you, whereas wherever there's a king, it's all hierarchical. There's the king at the top and the royal family and then all the important royalty-type people, and your goal is to butter up to them. You know, in India, they had a caste system, and if you're born in the lowest caste, you'll never be equal to a Brahmin who's in the higher caste. And so in Israel, everybody was equal because everyone was made in the image of the Creator, male and female.
Bill, and this is Kim Kennedy. How are you?
Great, Kim.
This is, as you're speaking, I'm realizing that this is such a unique idea. And in the context of the 16 and 1700s, when the Patriots did what they did, it truly was revolutionary. We take it for granted, but what they did and the ideas they put forth, you know, it was like they had three heads. I mean, you know, other nations, other peoples are looking at them like, what are you talking about? What is this concept? You're really talking about self-government?
Right, self-government. And it's interesting how Israel pioneered that. Several other aspects. Israel was the first country without a police system, because everyone was taught the law, everyone enforced the law. Israel was the first country with no standing army, because every young man was in the militia. Israel was also the first country with private land ownership. Mm-hmm. All those boring chapters where they did surveys and lots and divided mm-hmm. up the land. Mm-hmm. In Egypt, the Pharaoh controlled all the land. And in Israel, the land was permanently titled to the families. So if they got in a pinch and sold the land, every 50 years it reverted back. This prevented a person from gradually accumulating the land and becoming a dictator again. And so if you can control land, you can accumulate stuff, and the Bible called that being blessed. Karl Marx called it being a capitalist.
Yes.
And Israel was the had a bureaucracy-free welfare system. So when you harvested your field, you leaved the gleanings for the poor people to pick through. And so the poor were taken care of without someone collecting it all and doling it back to those that they want to get their vote so they can get reelected. That's the dilemma when you have a government-run welfare system, is the government is made up of people who want to be in office, and the temptation is to funnel the money to those that can help them to stay in power. But in Israel's case, the poor were taken care of, but it was bureaucracy-free, so everybody left the gleanings in the field. A couple other things. Israel, because of the law being addressed to each person, and the law saying not to lie and saying that God hates unjust weights and measures, Israel produced an honest system that was a basis for commerce, that you could trust people when you went to the market that they were going to deal honestly with you. And it's come down to us as your word is your bond. And yes. But then Israel also got to choose the leaders of their own tribes. So Moses, in Deuteronomy chapter 1, spake unto the children of Israel and said, how can I myself alone bear your cumbrance? Take you wise and understanding and known among your tribes, and bring them to me, and I'll make them rulers over you. And so Moses didn't go out amongst 3 million people and say, you, come here. No, he put it into the law that you're supposed to pick people known amongst your tribe. And then, so it was the people picking them and then sending them to Moses. Another place, Deuteronomy 16, the law said, judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates. which the Lord thy God giveth thee throughout thy tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. So he's telling the people, you pick them. And so this was a sort of a republic, right? The word republic is representative. Mm-hmm. And so so Israel was unique in these aspects. It was the world system turned upside down. So instead of a king with royalty and a hierarchy, it was flipped. Now, one other aspect of Israel is that they were the first literate populace. So in Sumeria, they had 1,500 cuneiform characters, but only the kings and the scribes could read them. It started as an accounting method for the king to keep track of everything he owned, all his grain. And in Egypt, they had 3,000 hieroglyphic characters. Not only was it complicated, only the pharaohs and the scribes could read them. The scribes actually kept them complicated on purpose for job security. They were needed to decipher them. It was a way of control, sort of like Virginia and Maryland prior to the Civil War. They had laws making it a crime to teach slaves to read.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And Frederick Douglass, in his autobiography, the Republican Lincoln freed the slaves. Democrats in the Deep South passed all the slavery and the Jim Crow laws. But Frederick Douglass wrote about how when he was a young slave, his slave master's sister-in-law was teaching him the alphabet. And the slave master walks in and yells at her and says, "Don't teach slaves to read. They'll grow discontent and want to run away." And so when Moses came down the mountain, at that time in Egypt, it was illegal for the slaves to read. And Moses did not come down the mountain with the law in a 1,500 cuneiform character language. He didn't come down with a 3,000-character hieroglyphic language. He came down the mountain with a law in a 22-character alphabet, which was so easy to learn the entire nation became literate. Israel is the first instance in history of an entirely literate populace where everyone could read. And not only could they read, they were required to read. So it was the priest's job to teach them the law that gave them equality and gave them rights, but it was also the priest's job to teach them to read, period.
Interesting.
And so the whole system of Israel was dependent on the priests teaching them the system, teaching them the law, and teaching them to read the law. And even Jesus, when he's in the Gospels, he says, "You have read, and you have seen it written." And he's addressing an audience that it's assumed that everybody that he's speaking to has read the law. But Israel was the first example in history of this, and this is why Samuel Langdon wrote an address, "The Republic of the Israelites, an Example to the American States." That was Harvard professor Samuel Langdon in 1788.
You know, as you speak, Bill, you explode the myths that have been spoken about how religion, Christianity in general, specifically, I should say, is repressive and backwards, and people are more enlightened now. And what you're describing is a very advanced society, and you can speak to this much better than I can. But that American society of the 1700s was very advanced, and many people could read, as compared to today, where illiteracy, you've got many people graduating from high school who can't read or barely read.
Right, we've seen where to control a people as a dictator, you need the people ignorant.
Right.
And so if you have a public education system that's all set up, you're faced with this dilemma of how can you keep this going but not actually teach anybody anything. And Plato talked about that, and maybe I'll get to that in a minute. But I did want to mention that in Israel, the whole system was dependent on the priests teaching the system. When the priests stopped doing it,
Yes. The
whole thing fell apart.
Right.
And so you have Eli, the high priest, his own sons were sleeping with women in the tent of tabernacle, of meeting with the Lord. Talk about in your face, the disrespecting God. There's a story of a Levite with a concubine. Now, the law said the Levites were to marry virgins of their own tribe, and here he is with a woman he's not even married to. And so it shows they were not teaching the law, much less living it themselves. And he's traveling with his concubine. They're at a house. It's surrounded by sodomites, and they bang on the door saying, "We want the guy in there." So there's something about that behavior that forces itself on others, and it's a sign of total unrestraint, indulgence that is the end of a culture or in a civilization where they're controlling themselves. And finally, you know, the backslidden Levite shoves the concubine out the door. She gets raped and dies. And the next day he comes out, says, "Get up." Well, she's dead, takes her body, chops it in 12 pieces, sends it to the 12 tribes of Israel. They all get together and they kill the sodomites. And by the time you're grossed out, you read the line that says, "Every man did what was right in their own eyes."
Wow.
And you think, why did they all do what was right in their own eyes? Well, the priests had stopped teaching them what was right in the Lord's eyes. And so the thing, traders, they all go to Samuel the prophet, and they said, "We want to be like all the other countries. We want a king." And Samuel cries, and the Lord tells him, "They did not reject you. They rejected me, that I should not reign over them." So they get King Saul, who turns around and kills most of the priests. He has Doeg the Edomite stab them all right in front of him. And so Yale president Ezra Stiles wrote, "The secular welfare of God's ancient people depended upon their virtue, their religion, their observance of that holy covenant which Israel entered into with God." And Samuel Langdon, again Harvard's president, said, "The only government which had a proper claim to a divine establishment was so far from including the idea of a king that it was considered a high crime for Israel to ask to be like other nations. When they were thus gratified, it was rather as a punishment." And so we see that it's a spectrum of power. One side's total government, the other side's no government. Total government, you get a king. No government is anarchy, unless the people have internal morals, and they're all guided by these internal morals. But if you think of it, why would you be motivated to obey these internal morals? Well, Israel added the key ingredient, God. This God of the Bible, this Judeo-Christian God, watches everybody, is going to hold you accountable in the next life, and wants you to be fair. So you're about to steal something, you know you can get away with it, and then you think, wait a second, God is watching, he wants me to be fair, he's going to hold me accountable in the next life, maybe I should hesitate stealing. And it creates this thing in your head called a conscience. So if everybody believes God is watching, he wants you to be fair, he's going to hold you accountable, everybody self-modifies their behavior, they follow these morals and values and virtues, and you can have complete order in society without police following everybody around.
And thank you for saying that, Bill, because that's viewed as a negative in our society, and it's not. It's a restrainer. It makes a society that functions at a very high degree. It makes life so much more pleasant. Another word for it, I think it's called the fear of the Lord. And that's, you know, it's the same thing that your parents put into you when you wanted to run across the street when cars were coming and you knew, you know, if you didn't listen to them, you were going to feel the repercussions of it. That's a good fear. That's a healthy fear.
And it only works with a Judeo-Christian God. And Islamic Allah said, "Oh, there's an infidel woman around. You can rape her. It's okay." You can lie to an infidel. You can steal from an infidel. And so the Judeo-Christian God says, even the stranger living amongst you is under the same law that you're under. That
Bill,
every man
let me
and woman.
Just, we're heading toward a break here. You're giving a wonderful overview, setting the stage and laying the foundation here for giving us an update on current events, which we really appreciate. This is fascinating. So we'll be heading to a break here in just a moment. We'll be back right after the news at the bottom of the hour. Thank you. Stay with us.
It is a gift from you. The world is turning in its place because you made it true. Lift my voice.
Working for your liberty right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. Donald Trump leads our new poll of Republican presidential candidates.
The latest Fox News poll has him up 15 percentage points since June, rising to 26%. Jeb Bush is next at 15. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is down 6 points since last month at 9%. Ben Carson falls in at 7%. Senator Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee are at 6. Senators Marco Rubio and Rand Paul are at 5. And Governors Chris Christie and John Kasich round out the top 10.
Fox Business Network's Rich Edson. A young man and a young girl killed in a circus tent collapse in Lancaster, New Hampshire during a gusty storm. 22 people are hurt. Brandon Isham was there.
People who were part of the circus just yelled, run. And I just see stakes and stuff coming up out of the ground. Next thing you know, the tent's coming up and over.
There was a severe thunderstorm warning in the area at the time. Fox News, we report. You decide.
Hi, I'm Doug Floro, President and Certified Financial Planner at MFB Wealth Management. In Matthew 25, the parable of the 10 talents warns us that not investing the master's talents because of fear is wrong. Doing nothing can be a sin.
So what are the consequences of doing nothing?
In this parable, the first thing we see is that the Lord is not pleased. The one talent is taken away and given to the one that has 10 talents. Finally, the unprofitable servant is cast into outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Wow, that sounds harsh.
It certainly does. Now, none of us is a perfect steward, but if you feel like you are just coasting along and it's time to make some changes, please call our office at 215-723-8999.
MFB Wealth Management, 215-723-8999, on the web at mfbwm.com. Securities and advisory services offered through Genios Wealth Management, member FINRA SIPC.
Welcome back, everyone, to It's a New Day here on 1180 WFYL, Working for Your Liberty. I'm Susan Locke, joined in the studio by Kim Kennedy. At the board is Mark Trinder. And our very special guest this morning is William J. Federer. Bill, welcome back. Please continue. You were laying the groundwork here of how government has been established through the centuries.
Right. So, and again, thank you for having me on. And I also sent out a daily email. It's called American Minute, and people can sign up for it at AmericanMinute.com. AmericanMinute.com.
Yes, and I would also like to mention, just looking you up and Googling you, people can do that and also see your lectures and speeches that you've given on YouTube. There's a wealth of information available online about you.
Well, I appreciate you mentioning that. I do a daily television program called Faith in History, and it airs on the TCT network, which is, I think, on DirecTV and different stations. But I wanted to mention how the natural trend is for power to want to concentrate, like a gravitational pull that wants to pull the satellite back to Earth. And so what America's founders did was counter human nature. It was what Israel did. And we took the rubber band and stretched it, and we put power into the hands of the people. And it mm-hmm. worked as long as the priest taught the law, and the law was empowered by this God that watches everybody, wants you to be fair, and is going to hold you accountable in the next life. And but when you get rid of this God, all you have is these internal morals, and people say, well, why obey them? And somebody's going to obey it out of social acceptance, but others are going to find a way around it. Water seeks its own level. Mm-hmm. So you're going to begin to have people robbing and stealing and smashing windows and setting buildings on fire, and then the country is going to yell, government, please step in and restore order.
Right, the anarchists.
The police will come down the street and they'll restore order. But when the dust settles, you'll have just transitioned forms of government from the people ruling themselves back to a king.
Yes.
And so this is a natural trend. Mm-hmm. And Washington warned about this in his farewell address. He said that disorders and miseries will incline the hearts of men to seek security in the absolute power of an individual who will turn this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty, and thus, whatever form of government you call it, it will be a despotism. And a despot is someone with absolute and arbitrary power.
On the ruins of public liberty.
And so the idea is that in times of crises, people want someone who can tell them what to do. And so we we see, Washington says that usurpation, in his farewell address, usurpation, though in one instance is the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. So usurpation is doing something you're not authorized to do, but you get away with it. And he says, usurpation, though in one instance, is the instrument of good. In other words, a leader says, I want to do something good. I'm just going to usurp a little power to do it. I'm going to take away power that's not mine, but I'm going to take it. And because I want to do something good, people say, well, he wants to do something good. Let him get away with it. And so he says, well, I don't have time to wait for Congress. I'm just going to do it. He says, well, he wants to do something good. I guess it's okay. Well, I don't have time to wait for this treaty to be ratified. I don't have time for this, that, and the other. And people say, well, he wants to do something good. And so we see that's how free governments are destroyed.
Yes.
In other words, our founders set up an inefficient form of government on purpose, slow to making good decisions, but thank God it was slow to making irreversible bad decisions.
Yes.
And they took the power of a king and broke it into three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial, and they pitted these branches against each other. There's one story that I use to help illustrate what our founders did. I'm one of 11 children, and I remember as a kid growing up, coming in from playing in the yard, my little brother and I saw there was one brownie left in the pan, and we were about to fight over it, and my mom said, one of you cuts it, but the other gets to pick the first piece. And the one cutting it doesn't know which piece he's going to get yet, so he wants to try to cut the pieces exactly what? Equal. And so it works great unless you did it with my little brother, because he spit on him and got both pieces. But if you can imagine a big brownie and three hungry boys, and you give them each a job, the first one's job is to trace out on the brownie where it is going to be cut. He does not know which piece he's going to get yet, so he tries to trace those pieces exactly what? Equal. The second one's job is to take the knife and actually execute it and cut the brownie. Now, he does not know which piece he's going to get yet, so he's going to try to cut them exactly what? Equal. And the third one's job is to judge and see who gets which piece. And so you have the legislative branch laying out the law, the executive branch signing it, executing it into law, and then the judicial branch judging the law. It was a stroke of genius. Their greedy, hungry tummies causing them to be honest. This would be like a Sunday school teacher giving an assignment. Go home and design a system of government where sinners keep other sinners from sinning. And so James Madison said, there are no angels amongst us. There's no perfect people that are impervious to temptation. Everybody has this selfish dictator DNA on the inside of them, and given opportunity, will want to concentrate power. And so what we do is we separate the power into these three branches and pit them against each other, and they'll cancel each other out. And it was a stroke of genius. Now, Washington warned in his farewell address, the only thing that can short-circuit this is parties, not drinking parties, but political parties. Because if two or more branches belong to the same party, it's like a tug-of-war, and they say, hey, let's both pull on the rope against the third side. Mm. And it begins to cause the thing to fall apart, and power reconcentrates. So it's a natural tendency for power to want to concentrate in the hands of a crisis. In other words, it was good that Lincoln wanted to end slavery, but in the process, a lot of rights were taken away from the states and concentrated in the federal government. It was good that Woodrow Wilson wanted to, you know, get us through World War I, but he concentrates power with his 17th Amendment, where the senators are elected by the people, not the state legislators. He pushed through the income tax. It was good that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to get us through the Depression, but he concentrates power with his New Deal programs and so forth. But there were also philosophers in history that wanted to speed this process along, and they noticed that in times of crises, people will surrender their rights and freedoms to a strong leader to restore order. And so they thought, well, gee, let's hurry this along by creating the crises. And so one was Machiavelli. He lived 500 years ago in Italy. Italy was a bunch of city-states. Venice, Genoa, Naples, Florence, Siena, and they all had armies and navies and fought. And Machiavelli thought if one prince could control all of Italy, it would stop the infighting. So he writes a book called The Prince, where he advocates the ends justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end that any means necessary to get there is justified. Lie, cheat, steal. So picture the scenario. If a prince conquers a city, they would hate him. But if the prince pays criminals to kill cows and burn barns and create crisis and terror, the people will cry out for help. The prince will come in and kill the very criminals he bribed. Nobody would know the better for it, and they would praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it.
Never let a crisis go to waste, Tom.
Exactly. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire. Then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher, and they'll pay anything for it and thank you for being there. Mm-hmm. And it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on a crisis to consolidate control. And now that was 500 years ago, and this has gone down in the political lexicon, and so nowadays every politician knows that you create or capitalize on crises to consolidate control. Another philosopher was Hegel, H-E-G-E-L, Hegel, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. He lived in Germany, Prussia, and Napoleon had conquered Prussia so easily that the next king, Frederick, said, we're not going to let that happen again. We need to strengthen the state. And so Hegel was the philosopher that said the state is God walking on earth, and the state is our mortal God. And so he came up with a way to strengthen the state, and it was called Hegelian dialectics. Now, it sounds complicated, but it's not. It's a triangle. One corner is a thesis. The opposite corner is an antithesis or antithesis. And the top corner is a synthesis. So you start off at the first corner, the thesis. You create the antithesis. In other words, you create a crisis and a problem that is real bad. And then everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. And that's the synthesis. And then the synthesis becomes the next thesis. Then you create another problem that's real bad. And everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. And you keep doing that over and over again until you move from freedom to bondage, from the people ruling themselves back to a dictator. Mm. Now, Karl Marx used this, and he would send in agitators and community organizers and labor organizers and agent provocateurs into communities to create the antithesis, to create the crises. And once there was blood in the streets, everybody was willing to surrender their freedoms to the government to restore order. Mm-hmm. And so Karl Marx would have the organize the proletariat against the bourgeois, which is the working class against the business owners. They would organize the poor against the rich, the blacks against the whites, mm-hmm. the Catholics against the Protestants, the Muslims against the Christians, the Hutus. Yeah, the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo and Rwanda. Mm-hmm. They really don't care who the two sides are or what the crisis is. And it works best if they're not Christian. Even Napoleon said, religion is what keeps the poor from murdering the rich. Well, if you get rid of religion, all you have is raw human passion, and you say, you've been wronged, you want what the other ones have, follow me, you'll get it. And you organize them to create this antithesis, to create this crisis. And then everybody wants somebody to restore order, and they surrender their freedoms, and you have a dictator. Now, this process was adopted by someone named Saul Alinsky.
Yes.
Now, for those not familiar, Saul Alinsky grew up in Chicago, and he apprenticed by riding around with Al Capone's hitmen, Frank Nitti, and saw how all you had to do was kill a few people, smash a few windows, and the whole neighborhood would submit to the mob and pay extortion protection money. And so Saul Alinsky applied this to politics and said, all you got to do is create a crisis, an antithesis that's really bad, and everybody's willing to surrender their freedoms and pay up to have the order restored and to have this crisis be passed with. So Saul Alinsky said the community organizer's first job is to create the issues or the problems. The organizer must first rub raw the resentments of the people of the community. The organizer polarizes the issue and helps lead his forces into conflict. An organizer must stir up dissatisfaction and discontent, fan the latent hostilities of many of the people to the point of overt expression. And he says a community organizer must search out controversy, for unless there is controversy, the people are not motivated enough to act. And so here, it's basically Proverbs 6, where it says six things the Lord hates. Mm-hmm. The last one, it says, he that soweth discord amongst the brethren.
Yes.
And so here we have the Hillary Clinton did her senior thesis at Wellesley College on Saul Alinsky, and our president was an organizer with the Saul Alinsky organizers in Chicago. And so the politics being played out on America is the creating and the capitalizing on a crisis to consolidate control. And so you have this natural tendency of people to want to surrender their freedoms and rights and power in a time of crisis. And then you have these philosophers of Machiavelli and Hegel and Saul Alinsky that talk about intentionally creating the crisis, wanting there to be racism, wanting to stir up class warfare, wanting the problems to get really bad and throw gasoline on them to get them real, real bad. And then everybody in the panic surrenders their freedoms, and then power is concentrated into the hands of a dictator. It's a predictable process, but unfortunately, most Americans are not familiar with it.
You know, Bill, you can't help but look at the end results of these tactics. I mean, what is Ferguson, Missouri like today after all those riots? Is there a lot better or worse?
Well, I lived a half mile from Ferguson, and 99% of the people that rioted were not from Ferguson.
Exactly.
They were brought in from Chicago. There were all these groups that were funded by George Soros. There was even these front groups were not paying the rioters. And so earlier in the summer, these rioters protested in front of the George Soros-funded group offices. And they would hold up signs saying, "You promised to pay us $5,000 if we rioted. Pay up." And they started an internet campaign called Cut the Check hashtag.
Wow.
You can go online and look at it. And so they were like, you know, "You promised us $5,000 if we had riot in Ferguson, now pay up." And so it's a rent-a-mob. And they
rent-a-mob.
Those exact same people go to Baltimore,
yep.
And then they get a liberal governor or a liberal mayor who tells the police to stand down so that the people can riot. And then it makes a lot of bad news, and then they say, well, the police are inadequate. We need to federalize these police forces, and basically the local communities are surrendering their autonomy. They're surrendering their independence, and you're seeing the creation of a standing army on our own soil.
Right.
And so now mix this together with Islam, and you see that a large number of Muslim immigrants are being brought into the country. Thousands and thousands of them, and no background checks. Christian refugees are turned aside and detained, but these Muslim immigrants, there's actually a UN group that's doing the resettlements, working together with liberal denominations, and once the liberal denominations take money, they cannot proselytize, so there's no effort to share the gospel with these people. They're just transplanted into local communities, rural communities. They overwhelm their Section 8 housing, their education, their medical service, free medical services. So 8,000 Somali Muslims being dropped off in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and 10,000 Syrian Muslims being dropped off in Boise, Idaho, and they want to bring 50,000 into Detroit, Michigan. And then the Muslims have infiltrated the drug gangs. And Hugo Chavez had been bringing Muslim terrorists over from Iran to Venezuela, teaching them Spanish and sending them north. And so they've been coming across our southern border as OTMs, other than Mexicans. 75 other countries are coming across our southern borders, Pakistanis, Turks, Somalis, Arabs, and they're being bused to cities all around America through the drug gang veins and downlines. They're going into the major cities and the inner cities. And so the thought is, Are we being set up for an Arab Spring? Could we possibly have Ferguson's and Baltimore's all across America between now and the next election? And instead of canceling an Orioles baseball game, maybe we'll be canceling elections. And hopefully that's all speculation. But there are these large amounts of Muslims being brought in with no background checks, no vetting, no security background checks. It's pretty certain that amongst these immigrants are those that hold to the fundamental views. And so we see this melding, this merging, this cross-pollinization between Islamic motivation using these communist agitation, Hegelian type tactics.
It's really an invasion of our country. Why do you think it is that our Congress people will do nothing about this, are doing nothing and will do nothing, and say that they cannot do anything?
Well, it is interesting that when it came out that the Congress was going to be subject to Obamacare, within 1 week, the House and the Senate rushed through the bills in the president's time. It's like, how can they get something done in 1 week? They can do it if they want. Well, I categorized it, especially with the large amount of Islamic immigration coming in. There's four reasons why politicians allow this. One is they're ignorant of all this, and you think of it, most politicians, their expertise is in some career, and they learned how to get elected. They don't have backgrounds in history or in economics or whatever. Some do, but a large percentage don't. And so number one is they're ignorant of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Two, they're afraid. They don't want to have fundamentalist Muslims protesting outside of their offices, and they don't want to get death threats, and they want to stay out of the news. So one, they're ignorant. Two, they're afraid. Three, they're on the take. They're getting donations. And we've seen this where wealthy Muslim from Saudi Arabia will make donations to campaigns. And once the politician gets in office, he's not as apt to want to say something against those that gave money to him. Or their businesses that do business with the Saudis and the different large, rich, financial Islamic countries. So one, they're ignorant, they're afraid, they're on the take. Or four, it's what's called taqiyya. It's where they're lying to you, and they have this agenda, and they're promoting this agenda, and they're just playing you for fools.
Is it legal for them to accept money from foreign entities and from Muslim countries, organizations, companies, and so on?
Well, that's where you get into the problem. The people that make the law have a temptation to want to feel they're above the law. And many philosophers through history have cited that. But I do want to point out one interesting aspect about America, and that's the question of who is the king? Who is the king in America? Now, it's sort of a trick question. You got to think of it for a minute. Who is the king? Well, one of the signers of the Constitution, Gouverneur Morris, said, "The magistrate is not the king. The people are the king." Chief Justice John Jay said, "The people are the sovereign of this country." Andrew Jackson said, "The people are the government, the sovereign power." James K. Polk said, "The president, the people are the only sovereigns recognized by our Constitution." Gerald Ford said, "Never forget that in America, our sovereign is the citizen. The state is a servant of the individual. It must never become an anonymous monstrosity that masters everyone." General Omar Bradley said, "In the United States, it is the people who are sovereign. The government is theirs to speak their voice and to voice their will." And so in countries where there's a king, the king is the king. But in America, the people are the king. It's the whole thing turned upside down, sort of like Israel. And so if you can imagine yourself visiting a king, maybe an Old Testament king, and you're going through the streets of Jerusalem and you're witnessing crimes and murders, and you finally get into the king's chamber, and he has his head in his hand, and he says to you, "Did you see all that crime coming in here? I wish somebody would fix it." And you reach over and tap him on the shoulder and say, "Excuse me, you're the king. This is your kingdom. You're the one accountable to God to fix this mess." That's like somebody in America watching TV or listening to the radio and hearing all the terrible things going on, saying to themselves, "I wish somebody had come along and fixed this mess." Hello, reach through the TV tube and reach through the radio speaker and tap you on the shoulder. You are the king. The politicians are your servants.
Exactly.
You don't just have the privilege of voting in America. You will be held accountable to God for what you allow those politicians to do. They're your servants.
That's right. And think of those who've gone before us and given everything for this right that we have.
Yeah. And then I speak at pastors' conferences, and I put a picture on the screen of Emperor Theodosius in 379 A.D. Now, this is after Constantine had become a Christian, and so the Roman Empire is Christian, and the emperor is Christian, and the Emperor Theodosius is going to a church in Milan, Italy, where the pastor is Bishop Ambrose. And so there's this famous picture of Bishop Ambrose, rebuking the Emperor Theodosius. Now, I tell the pastor, I said, could you imagine having the emperor sitting in your pew on Sunday? And I said, guess what? He is. In America, the people are the king, and 70-plus percent identify themselves as Christian, so they're going to somebody's church. And so it's like you have the king sitting in your pews, the people. And there's two different types of counselors to the king. One wants the king to stay asleep, and the other wants the king to wake up. If you've seen the movie The Lord of the Rings,
yes. Mm-hmm.
There was the one scene of a King Theoden that has this spell cast on him, and he's all gray and a gray beard and gray eyes.
We were just talking about that last week. That's right.
And so
that's
the people
exactly right.
In America, the people are the king, and we like have this spell cast on
and
us.
And we must wake up. You are helping us
counselor.
To do that, Bill. We only have 30 seconds left. I cannot thank you enough. We could talk to you for hours. Thank
you
so
back,
much. We hope you will come back.
Please come
I'd be
back.
Happy
People
to.
People will call and ask questions. We just thank you for this charge that you've set before us. It is up to us. We, the people, are responsible for what's happening. We must do something.
That's right. American
thank you. Yes. Thank you so much for being with us today. God bless you.
Thank you.